This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Meera Sivasodhi. It's our psychiatry series. And today in the studio with me is Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq Amir Noordin. He's a consultant psychiatrist from the University of Malaya Medical Center. Today we're discussing a new campaign which is supposed to be launched every October. It's called Let's Talk Malaysia. This is Ministry of Health. They're supposed to be launching the National Strategic Action Plan for Mental Health 2019 to 2025 this month, and we're going to be checking out what this is all about policy direction for mental health, what this campaign is going to achieve, and where the national dialogue about mental health should take us. Welcome to the show, Dr. Amir. How are you today?
Good, thanks.
Dr. Amir, based on your work and engagement with various stakeholders, how has awareness about mental health changed? Do you think it has changed very much over the years?
Well, thanks for having me, Meera. It's one of the first ones. It's been a while since we last met each other.
My first one-on-one interview with you.
Yeah, the last time I was with Dr. George, my friend.
It was, and you don't really get much of a chance to talk in that.
Yes. George takes all over. I think that things have changed a lot, actually, since we last met. I think we last met early 2015.
That's right.
It was during the start of the electronic cigarette issue. That's what I remember, because George was asking me about that question. So it's been about 4 years since then. And I think in terms of mental health per se, and mental illness as a subject, things have really changed for the better. You know, as you probably know, there have been a few wins, if you want to call wins this year, where at least one of the insurance companies has come out with a rider. And also the government has, in a way, subsidized the Befrienders and Talian Kasih hotline so that it's free. So these are positive things that's happening in terms of mental health. And I think it's got a lot to do with the increasing awareness on the issue in the country and also on the ground.
Okay. You mentioned insurance policy. You know, yes, we do know a company has introduced a rider for mental health, but mental health, one of the main reasons why insurers say they cannot provide mental health coverage is because of the lack of epidemiological data. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, you know, I've raised this issue as well in other forums. In terms of the research, so I think one of the comments or the issues that was raised by the insurance company is the lack of information and data, and I think I have to agree with them that it is quite a bit of a challenge to get a lot of research on mental health and mental illnesses, particularly if you're looking at the various types of mental illnesses. I think when we're talking about, even in terms of the awareness, there is now a growing amount of awareness in depression, because that's what we often talk about quite a bit. The reason being is that the risk for suicide and suicide ideations is strongest with that particular diagnosis. But when we're talking about mental health or mental illness as a big subject, then we need research in all the various types of mental illnesses out there, whether it's bipolar mood disorder, whether it's schizophrenia, whether it's anxiety disorders, and the many more. You know, often, even on social media, I've also recently seen people criticizing some of us who've done some awareness work in saying that, you know, you're giving a lot of focus on depression, but what about, say, for example, adult ADHD? Or what about schizophrenia? Are we less important compared to depression? The answer is definitely no. It's just that we need to start somewhere where people are a little bit more familiar. And as we've seen with other medical conditions, they start to become a little bit more specialized as we get more familiar and aware about the issue as a whole.
We do know as a society, stigma is still there when it comes to mental health. What kind of conversations do you think we need to have about mental health so people can come out, are able to come out and talk about it? And especially in organizations, slowly you find that there are younger people who are going through some kind of depression or mental health issue, but are very much afraid because, you know, they are concerned that, you know, their jobs are at stake, or, you know, they're not terribly sure as to what they should be doing. So what sort of conversations can we have to sort of tell people that it is all right, it is okay to talk about it, you're not going to be are stigmatized for it. And are we having those right conversations?
Yeah, well, I fully agree with you there, Mira, in terms of the conversations that we need to have. And I think we need to have open, frank discussions. And we need to have them continuously. You know, prior to going on air, I've just had a chat with a number of colleagues about, for example, the awareness campaigns that we've had in the past, which have been rather cyclical, or at least focused on certain months, like October, mm-hmm. because October is World Mental Health Day. We need to have continuous discussions and conversations about mental health throughout the year. And therefore, it becomes something that is a little bit more of the norm, which will then reduce the stigma. And I think it needs to transcend beyond health. Because mental health or mental wellness, another way of looking at it, goes not only in health, but also in societies, also in terms of work, also in terms of scholastic abilities, and also in terms of, for example, gender roles. And I think the discussion about how important is your mental health or why mental health is important needs to be, in a way, conversed in multiple platforms by multiple agencies and people. And therefore, the stigma then will reduce. Because as you rightly mentioned, at the moment, even talking about, for example, mental health issues at the workplace, you know, I just found out that we don't really have a standard on what we should be doing if someone is having a mental health problem in the workplace. Often it's going to be an SOP that's devised by the certain ministry or the certain company on how they would actually address a person with a diagnosis of, say, depression or bipolar or anxiety disorders. There's really no, you know, big policy that I'm aware of that you know, gives some guidance to human resource on how to actually handle a person that might have a diagnosis. Because mental health, mental illnesses particularly, are diverse, and the prognosis are also diverse. You know, if you're diagnosed, say, for example, with depression, it's not the same as being diagnosed, say, for example, with schizophrenia. You know, the prognosis is totally different. So you can't put one certain model for just one particular condition. You know, you've got to be aware about how might a certain condition affect these individuals. And I think when that happens, then we're able to reduce the stigma, particularly workplace, for example.
Do you know, Dr. Amir, could you give me an example of how we could address depression, for an example, of someone in the workplace? How do we manage that? How do we address it, as you were mentioning?
Yeah. So first of all, we need to be aware that there is something called depression. I think that's the first thing, being aware, and that's why we've done these national campaigns, we've done campaigns on mental health and mental illness. And then secondly, when we are aware that there is a condition, that people might be affected with a condition called depression, for example, then they might need to know what to do with these certain situations. So if you get somebody who you look, you know that is having, for example, a hypertension problem or a blood pressure problem, you'd advise them to go and see a GP or the pharmacist to check their blood pressure, yeah? So similarly, if you notice that somebody might be exhibiting symptoms of depression, you might want to ask them how they're feeling. And I think the first thing is to ask, because just leaving them alone quietly is not going to help. And secondly, as we've shared with some of the community that we're doing, once an individual opens up and says that he has a problem, then I think for us, it's our responsibility, I think, as a society, to at least know where to find help for this person. And as I've shared before, you know, it could be to the lowest level of at least, you know, telling him that, you know, it looks like you might be struggling with depression. Why don't you Google and see where there might be places for you to attend? That's one. If you are one level up, you might even know where to find that help for them, at least online, so that you can actually share with them a certain website. For example, either the Ministry of Health website or the one that I have, mentalhealth.my, for example. And if you want to go one level higher than that, you actually share with them which are the specific hospitals or clinics or facilities that might be able to cater for them. And of course, you can go even another level where you actually bring that person to the hospital or even go and register the person to the clinic, specific clinic. So there are various levels of help which you can actually do. If you've got somebody at the workplace, for example, knowing what's available in your organization might be helpful. Often in human resources, they will have either a counselor or psychologist that might be able to assist to do at least some level of assessment. Some companies are a bit more advanced. They have an occupational health person in there which might be able to help. And again, these people will then be able to direct them to the right places for help if needed.
You know, we have a huge number of SMEs in Malaysia, small and medium-scale enterprises, and, you know, they don't have the luxury of having an in-house counsellor or even a psychologist or, you know, anything to that extent. And I do admit, to a very large extent, people are getting more aware of these mental wellness issues. However, cost is a huge problem. You know, we don't have enough psychiatrists or psychologists in government sector, and the private sector does cost quite a lot of money. So how do organizations address that?
Okay, that's true. The other method that we could also help is that, you know, most of these SMEs will be linked with a panel clinic. So you've got your general practitioners, which will be able to at least assess and assist these individuals to decide whether or not they need to be referred to further support if required. I think in terms of the... I do agree that we don't have enough psychiatrists, for example, yet even lesser psychologists, at least certified psychologists, in the health system. But I think our health system in general is fairly complete. You know, we've got the access to both public and private services. They are for the public services particularly, they're very affordable. And we have at least within the mental illness services, a psychiatrist in all the big hospitals. And now they've also started to deploy psychiatrists in the smaller hospitals, hoping to have, I think, every hospital with at least a psychiatrist. And within that psychiatrist team, often there'll be a team of at least some social workers and psychiatric nurses. And I think that itself might be able to assist. Now, going back to what you shared at the very beginning in terms of the National Strategic Plan, for example, now I'm not part of the committee, but I'm aware that there are talks about putting it more into the community, which means that the focus will also move towards primary care. And I think if you talk about Western and developed countries, often your first point of contact to access mental health services would be through the general practice, general practitioner. And for us in Malaysia, we have the private and the public general practitioners out there, which might be able to assess and assist.
We'll come back and find out more about the National Strategic Action Plan for Mental Health, as well as moving this sort of service to the community. I've had chats with people in Australia who do that now. Communities, head of communities are trained to deal with the mental health issues. You know, I have a question about how our primary healthcare system is very weak, Dr. Amir, and how that's going to help with this sort of situations. All of that coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. In our Health and Living segment today, Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq, Amir Nurdin. He's a consultant psychiatrist from University of Malaya Medical Centre. We're discussing in our psychiatry series, Let's Talk Malaysia, which is a new campaign initiated by the Ministry of Health. It is a campaign to be held every October. And that's what we're discussing today, how this campaign or how this Let's Talk Malaysia is actually going to be working and what this National Strategic Action Plan is going to be about. You've spoken about the National Strategic Action Plan for Mental Health, Dr. Amir. What is it really?
Yeah, so first of all, let me just correct you a little bit in terms of the campaign name. Apparently, it's changed to Let's Talk Minda Sihat.
Oh, yeah, really? So, that was quick.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes these things happen quite fluidly.
Okay.
But nevertheless, I think if you're talking about a campaign, Let's Talk Minda Sihat, or Healthy Mind is probably good in itself. But Let's Talk Malaysia is us moving on with the theme of World Health Day, I think, of 2016, where depression was one of the issues that was discussed.
It was
and
the
it was
theme.
Yeah,
that's
and it
right.
was Let's Talk. But I think what's more important, as you've mentioned, is to destigmatize and let's talk Minda Sehat or let's talk Malaysia or let's talk MAI in the shorter form, has that particular objective of increasing mental health awareness and also destigmatizing mental illness in the community.
But just in the month of October, do you think that's going to work very much?
So, you know, when we proposed it, we proposed it for a year long. You know, it was meant to be something like the Tak Nak campaign of the past, where a lot of discussions and issues will be talked about in terms of mental health. And as we discussed in the first part, that, you know, if you just want to do a month-long campaign, you can't cover the many types of mental illnesses out there, nor the many types of solutions that we have for improving mental wellness or mental health. But I think it's a start because if you recall, this particular idea was raised by our Yang Berhormat, Minister of Health. But after a discussion with our Deputy Prime Minister, together with multiple stakeholders, I remember, if I'm mistaken, inside there was YB Hana, there was Minister of Communications, and also YB Syed Saddiq from the youth and sports. So there are many people involved in making this campaign, I think, a success. Now, more importantly, just after that particular meeting, there was a conference called, I think, My Hack by, surprisingly, not health groups. It was actually run by a group from, I think, the business side. So Ministry of Works was there as well, and there were some positive signs about his involvement in mental health.
Ministry of Human Resources?
Human Resources. So there are, you know, these are, I think, positive movements in the mental health sphere, because in the past, we always talk mainly about the Ministry of Health. Now, I also know that more recently, as of I think last week, a lot more discussions are going on in the Ministry of Education on this particular issue as well, and I think rightly so, because we've got, you know, mental illnesses often happen in youth groups. And that's where lots of the issues with stress happens, and I think they need to look into that issue. So what I'm trying to say is that in 2019, when we talk about mental health and mental illnesses, there are many more agencies on board. And I think that's another reason why I said just now that the awareness has improved, where other ministries feel that they want to participate and help out in actually reducing the burden. Because you have to remember that the recent 2015 data was 29.2% of Malaysians struggling with a mental health issue. And 2019 is when we do the next census. So we want to see whether that number is the same or below. I hope it doesn't go up.
Yeah, that's one in three.
Yeah, that's one in three. That's a lot of people.
Yes.
And that particular statistics or census was across the board. They were looking at Malaysians in general, from young to old. So it's a conversation that needs to be done by many, many types of stakeholders. So going back to your original question about the National Strategic Plan, like I said, I'm not part of this particular committee, but I'm aware that they are currently in the final phases of that that plan. And I think that it's going to be a good plan, because what I've heard is that they'll be moving towards a community-based agenda. And I think this is in keeping with what I've heard from the Minister of Health, Minister of Health himself, in terms of the reforms that he wants to do for mental health. So I think this is a commitment by the government in improving the mental health of its people. Because if you recall the WHO's definition of health, you need to have social well-being, physical health, and mental health for a person to be
social as well.
Be defined as healthy.
Yeah.
And I think having a reform looking into this issue as a whole, and I think YB Zul has many times mentioned that this is part of his, you know, big change as a Minister of Health. I think it's a positive thing for us as a whole. So I'm looking forward for this National Strategic Plan, which I heard hopefully will be out by next year.
Okay. I thought it was going to be announced this month.
Well, I've got to admit, I'm not part of it, so I'm not so sure. Okay. But they might announce it, but I'm aware that it's probably going to be implemented next year.
Okay. I'm just going to think like the critics and those who are jaded, who are going to be thinking, here we go with another plan again. We have plans, all over the place for every reason. Mm-hmm. And what makes you think this will be a success?
Well, first of all, I'm just like you, Mira. I always get a bit skeptical as well in terms of plans.
Yes.
So one part of being making sure that the plan works is to be in committees that hopefully hold these colleagues of mine accountable, as we've done for, say, for example, tobacco control. But I think the difference this time around is the people that are involved in this national strategic plan who I'm aware that, you know, the ones who are involved are actually active on the ground. Secondly, is that they've had a number of stakeholder meetings with various people, including people with lived experience, from my understanding. And again, I think this moots well in terms of building a plan of such. The third is moving towards the community is something that's a little bit more easy for us to hold accountable, because you know, it goes into more public sphere where we'll be able to hopefully call upon things that are not happening. And I think this is another important thing about this Let's Stop Minda Sehat campaign, you know, and as I've mentioned to colleagues and also public, it's not just about hearing the good things, you know, it's also about sharing the negative or the places where we want improvement to be made. I'm quite a big believer in that. And I think the Minister of Health, from my conversations with him, is also a believer in that as well. So we want to know what's working, and we want to compliment those who are doing good work, but we also want to know what's not working and hopefully improve on those areas as well. And that's why I urge the public, where the campaign goes on, and I heard that the hashtag will be Let's Stop Minda Sehat, all same word, or you could also use Let's Stop MY, because that was the one that was used before. And I'm pretty sure that we'll be looking at those two hashtags to understand what the public wants or what the public thinks needs improvement in terms of mental health.
And when you talk about the strategic plan, it's going to outline the what. Will it outline the how?
I think it outlines both, if I'm not mistaken. At least my experience working in another strategic plan looks at both.
Okay. So you've got multiple stakeholders who are going to be involved in this. What about the private sector, corporations, who need to be invested as well? Because, you know, everyone works. Everyone goes to work.
Yeah. I think they are involved. Some of them are already starting to be a little bit more involved. For example, through their foundations mainly. I'm aware that at least Yayasan Saim Darby is already working with an NGO, Miasa. I'm also aware that Yayasan CIMB also has worked with Befrienders. So I think the at least the private bodies are getting involved. And as I mentioned just now, that there was a conference that was initiated by those people in the industry, actually, which was, to me, the first time that at least I'm aware of, that they have come on board. And I think they're seeing that there are issues that they want to raise. And that conference, I think, was one platform. I remember that the person organizing was, I think, Mrs. Sangeeta and Mr. Adit. So they're, you know, they're people that are involved, and they're very active on social media to push for change.
We have the National Mental Health Policy in place. We've had the National Strategic Action Plan for Suicide Prevention 2012 to 2015. Will those still exist, or will it be incorporated into this new National Strategic Action Plan for Mental Health?
My understanding is that they will be incorporated as a whole, and I think that's how it should be.
Okay. Let's talk about policy and legal action that have been proposed, which have not really come to fruition. The decriminalization of suicide. Now, have we gone very far with that? I mean, we're trying to decriminalize drug addiction.
Yep.
But what about suicide?
I think it's already already been discussed as well. And to my understanding, at least, it's really at quite an advanced juncture. I'm aware, I think they had a recent meeting a few months ago. When I say a few months ago, within the last 3 months, if I'm mistaken, again, discussing with this with multiple stakeholders. So I think they're quite committed to decriminalization of suicide. And I think it should be so, because you don't want to penalize somebody who's really seeking help in a way. It's the last resort to have a criminal record, which I think does a few things. One,
what was the logic, Doctor? I mean, for the life of me, I could not get my head around why we would want to criminalize suicide.
My understanding is that it was even there in the Mental Health Act prior to independence, or it was at least in some act prior to independence. So it's a long, it's one of those acts that's been there for quite a long time. That probably needs a bit of revision. Now, to the best of my understanding, it has not been used often in terms of being, legally used in court. It's more, I don't know why it's there, but we've not actually used it as well. But I think we really need to, at least, if you're not going to use it, at least state it. And put it in clearly that we don't want that thing to be there.
We also had the National Suicide Registry in the past, but that was discontinued in 2009. I think it's important, but what do you think?
I think it's really important, Mira, to be fair. And I'm, a little bit upset in terms that it was not continued because I think we missed an opportunity there. And again, I tweeted to YB Minister about this. Where if we had the suicide registry, we'll be able to at least have some data about the trends of suicide in 2019. Because particularly in the last at least 2 years, we've heard some really unfortunate incidences that have happened. And again, our last data set was going to be 2009 prior. So we've lost a bit of a gap there. I've been informed that they want to put it in, and I'm still waiting for that to come on board. And I think we really need that registry, at least to be able to assist us in terms of, methods, for example, and populations at risk, so that when we do any activities and also when we're doing intervention, we'll be able to target them. You know, this is a really big move because when I was in medical school not too long ago,
let's not go down that path. You were in medical school. Happy you went there.
I was overseas, and I remember that they said that, where are you from, Malaysia? I said, you don't have this problem with suicide. And I think now in 2019, if we were to go back into that same medical school, unfortunately, that we can't say that anymore because, number one, we probably have data. Number two, with social media and the current way that media is reported now, even if your issue is in a small remote island somewhere, because of social media, you'll be able to get that news in most countries now. So I suspect that, if you were to say the same thing in the past, like I'm from Malaysia, and you say that you don't have a suicide problem, it's not true because there have already been reported of deaths as a result of suicide.
However, we do know with a registry, there will be pushback. So the thought of me having a mental health issue and being included as part of a registry is a scary thought as to what that information could do to me and my future.
Yep.
How will we make sure that, this information will not be abused or will not even get leaked out?
Well, I think in the past, it's been more of, if the death is quite clear-cut, it will be recorded as such. It's when the death is not very clear that there'll be a team behind it that will be doing, in a way, forensic investigations onto that untimely or suspicious death. And it will be recorded in the registry, but if I'm not mistaken, the details are not there. So it's more of just trying to get the true problem at hand with the registry. But in terms of implicating families and individuals, and again, these are people who have already passed on. My understanding is that it doesn't go that far into implicating those individuals.
What about insurance?
Again, most untimely deaths, for example, will be reported as such. Suspicious death, unclear death, or whatever it is that they report. They don't specifically put suicide there. Any clear-cut suicidal act that's reported, insurance will definitely be involved. But I think the rest, what I'm made aware of is that it's, you know, it's they take it as it is.
You spoke about how the plan is to move mental health support to the community.
Yeah.
You've spoken about GPs, for an example, taking on a bigger role in diagnosing. And what happens after that? I mean, the GPs can diagnose, but where do they go after?
Yeah. So in terms of getting them on board. First of all, it's, you know, stigma doesn't just happen in the community. It also happens within the profession as well. You know, that's why, for example, some individuals might go to certain practitioners and then they would not be seen. They would be asked to go and see other practitioners who have a more acceptance maybe or are able to deal with mental health issues. Now, I also have to say that there are certain medical schools, particularly in the past, that might not have put a big emphasis on mental health or psychiatry as a subject matter. So colleagues that do come out, some of them might, you know, might want to help out, but they're not fully equipped, particularly as they've advanced into their careers. So having them on board within hopefully a policy means that the education of medical graduates and also graduates already needs to be improved in terms of at least mental health care. You know, you at least need to know depression, for example, how to assess suicide. Now, I know doctors know this, but I think they probably some of them probably need a bit of a refresher course. And again, it destigmatizes. It just makes them a little bit more comfortable with these discussions. And then know where to access help and what type of help is available. I mean, we know of many times where, you know, services are available, but we don't actually know that they are available. And I think there needs to be a bit more improvement in communication of where these services are so that the at least the practitioners will also be able to refer. And again, when we talk about mental health care per se, we have to not forget that it's not just doctors. You know, there are other mental health care providers, you know, certain social workers, most of them are trained as counsellors, actually. Some of your human resources are trained as counsellors and psychologists. You've got clinical psychologists out there. You need to be very sure about who they are. You've got certain psychiatric nurses. So these are nurses who have sub-specialised in mental health. We call it post-basic training. So they might be able to assist, particularly if they've retired or maybe private bodies hire them, for example. Then these are nurses that have a wealth of experience in dealing with people with mental illnesses, which might be helpful, particularly for certain services. So there are a number of people that we can refer to, but you just need to know the various roles that they play so that at least the referral is a little bit more smoother. And as I mentioned before, that most of the government hospitals particularly have psychiatrists involved and they often work in teams. And most of the private hospitals at least have a resident psychiatrist, if not a visiting psychiatrist. So again, healthcare is not so difficult in terms of accessing. And now we want to improve that a little bit more by equipping our colleagues on the ground, the general practitioners, to be able to at least assess and assist with simple cases. But we know that they're not trained as psychiatrists, they're general practitioners, for example. So the least they could do then, if they're unable to manage, know where the resources are for them to refer. Rather than somebody comes to you and then before even seeing, you feel ill-equipped and therefore you refer off. And that creates a burden in the hospital system because you get a bit of soft cases coming in, which is fine. We don't mind seeing them. It's just that in terms of the number of people that we're seeing, it might be a bit of a problem.
But then let's move that support maybe closer to home and see how we can, if there is a possibility of parents playing a role when it comes to adolescents. I mean, 1 in 5 adolescents in Malaysia is depressed. 2 in 5 are anxious. 1 in 10 are stressed. What can we do at home to help support before we actually go out? We'll come back and find out more up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. If you have just joined us, I'm Mira Sevasodhi. In the studio with me, Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq, Amir Nordin. He's a consultant psychiatrist from University Malaya Medical Centre. We're discussing in our psychiatry series, Malaysia's new initiative called Let's Talk, Let's Talk Minda Sehat is what it's known now, Dr. Amir. I didn't know that. I thought it was Let's Talk Malaysia. Okay, Let's Talk Minda Sehat is what it's called. We're also planning to launch the National Strategic Action Plan for Mental Health 2019 to 2025. As you said, now that's probably going to change a little, probably going to be launched sometime next year. We're not terribly sure yet, but that's in the pipeline. It's happening. So as we were talking about, when it comes to adolescents, a lot of issues are happening in this group of people. We've spoken about GPs supporting more and, you know, NGOs and a lot of support out there. But what about the home itself, Doctor? I mean, what's happening that our adolescents are depressed, are anxious, are stressed? You know, what is happening?
Well, I think first of all, if you're a parent in 2019, it's really a challenge, to be fair, compared to, you know, for some of us growing up a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. It's just that the kind of opportunities and threats that are available just becomes immense, you know. With social media, of course, as we know, that there are positive things on it. You know, you can do certain things like this campaign that we want to do. At the same time, it increases the risk of other issues like cyberbullying, for example, issues of comparing with other people, you know, the haves and the have-nots, for example, is another problem. And of course, being exposed to a lot more information than you would want to have at that age. And this, I think, contributes a little bit to the issues of mental health in the country. Now, of course, we also know that as we urbanize, the stresses in general in every family unit increases a little bit. You know, whereby in the past, maybe one parent is working, the other one does not need to work. Now both parents are working, and therefore the children are left literally at their own devices. I mean, we've heard about latchkey kids, but of course they increase a little bit in this day and age. I mean, I can give you an example. You know, as we're having this haze, which I have to say is really bad, mm-hmm. and if it goes up to a certain level and they close schools, you know, I can imagine the kind of panic or disruption that happens, because suddenly, you know, you don't have that system where, you know, something's happened where you're, like in the past, it wouldn't be a problem because mom might be at home or dad might be at home. But now both of them are at work fully, and therefore when they have these kind of unannounced situations, it just causes a little more problem, which also means that these kids are mostly sometimes at their own devices, mm-hmm. and parents unfortunately or fortunately are sometimes unable to cater fully to their children. And I think this might increase a little bit of the threats that might be out there in terms of increasing mental health issues. Now, I think what we need to understand is that parenting is something that we can learn. I think that's the first thing. It's not, you know, people assume that you become a parent and you're able to parent. Every new parent I'm aware of goes through a bit of a transition. So the firstborn is often the guinea pig. Mm-hmm. The second and third often get a little bit better. but generally, they have that, you know, there might be a little bit more work that needs to be done there. The second one is in terms of awareness about issues. You know, we get more aware about, for example, why we need to vaccinate now. We get more aware about, for example, childhood obesity. Now I think we need to get more aware that there are going to be some children that are more vulnerable towards mental health issues, and parents need to look out for this. And as I mentioned before just now, just be able to ask, and ask in a non-judgmental way. Because you want to have open conversations with your children so that they'll be able to share with you what they're dealing with. Because as I mentioned, it's a bit different now. You know, you can't assume the way that we lived a few years ago is the same as the current world that is now. There's just so many changes that our children are facing, which we need to be at least aware and have that open conversation with them so that they know that they are being listened to and that they can call us for help if they require that help. I think that's quite important in improving.
What about mental institutions? Do you think there's still a need for mental institutions in Malaysia?
I think there is a role for them, but to be fair to the mental institutions, there are four of them in Malaysia, if not where. One in Sabah, one in Sarawak, one in Johor, and one in Perak. So they cover for the Borneo and also the west of Malaysia. What's been happening over the last at least 10 to 15 years is that they've started to deinstitutionalize patients, which means that in the past they might have many beds, they've committed to people long-term care, which they've now moved towards more of a downsizing of the beds and more community-based work. So these mental institutions particularly now have a bigger role in doing lots of community-based mental health, mental illness rehabilitation programs. You know, I'm aware of the good work that's being done in Johor and Perak particularly. And of course, you know, not to forget Sabah and Sarawak, but the ones I'm aware of most is the ones in Perak and Johor. And they were, in a way, the models that the development of this community-based psychiatric services called Mentari, which now I think there's about 20 of these odd centres. Now, in my institution, for example, and University of Kebangsaan in Malaysia, also we have a community-based psychiatry rehab centre as well, which again looks at providing that kind of care beyond the hospital, or at least moving towards more of a non-long-term care and more of a, you know, stay at home, come to service, get something done, and then, you know, go back. And in those particular areas, they've got lots of activities that not only help in improving people's mental illnesses, but also in trying to get work to support the employment programs, and also to be more available or more included into communities through the various programs that they have.
You know, you spoke about how one in three of us has a mental health issue. And with the stress on families today to put food on the table, and if there is indeed an individual in the family who needs long-term care, it can be more stress mm-hmm. on the family unit to manage. It may not be your children, it could be a sibling, it could be an elderly person. That's even more burden on the family unit. Is there a way around this? And I'm not sure if you have enough resources for rehab and all of that. I mean, one in three is a big number. So will we be able to cope with all of this?
I hope we are able to. I have to admit that it's going to be a bit of a challenge. Again, you rightly mentioned it, particularly in the cities. If you have a sibling, family member with a mental health problem, often it causes a bit of strain in terms of caring. So we do know that there are private mental health facilities out there that are able to take certain people for a bit of long stay, or at least mid to long stay, to help with, for example, compliance with treatment, mm-hmm. Especially after an acute admission, because sometimes they just are not too well, but they're well enough to be home, but not well enough to be at home,
yep.
You know, and there might be that bit of a transition period. Overseas, they've got these stages where you get admitted in an acute facility, and then you get admitted to sort of a less acute facility, and then you go to the community before you go home. We don't really have that kind of system over here. And therefore, sometimes these private, in a way, rehabilitation centres for psychiatric patients might be helpful for certain families that might require them. We also know that there are NGOs that also do some rehabilitation programs, but again, they're always under-resourced. And their manpower is mainly volunteers, which again is a resource issue. So that needs to be looked into as well. But you're right, there is going to be that issue if we don't plan it well. And that's why I said that I'm quite hopeful that my colleagues have thought about these issues that we're discussing.
I'm already feeling overwhelmed. We have such a long way to go, don't you think?
We do, but I think I'm seeing a bit more hope, Amira, because working in this field for quite some time, what we've seen this year alone gives me hope that, you know, we'll be able to weather this storm, if that's the word to use. But I think, you know, there are lots more commitment and lots more people involved now than when I first started a few years ago. And I think that's where I think hope comes in. And you have to remember that our patients are also getting a bit more advanced, if that's the word to use. And I think they're demanding for improved mental health services. And I think that's very positive. And the best part, I think, is that we're also reciprocating that way. You know, we're not too defensive, at least. We do take their opinions very strongly. And I think some of the changes that have happened, at least in my hospital, is a result of the feedback that we're getting from people who are struggling with these issues. You know, the way that we facilitate the facilities in the hospital itself, waiting time, for example, you know, how we organize the wards, has a lot to do with the feedback that we've received over the years from our patients. And I think with the conversation that we're going to have with Let's Talk Minda Sehat, we'll be able to open up this particular conversation to a lot more people. And because it's a national campaign, and now with social media, you have a hashtag, we'll be able to understand the public a little bit more compared in a more anonymous fashion, if that's a word to use. Because you don't have to say, hi, my name is Amir, you know, yeah. I've got this problem. You know, it could be anonymously mentioned, but we will take all the feedback that comes out and we improve on the areas where we think needs improvement. And of course, like I said, compliment the people who have done the good work in the certain areas. Because, you know, people sometimes need that bit of, you're doing, you know, a good job. Because if not, they'll be wondering, like you said, you know, why am I doing all this thing? Correct. But at the same time, those who are not doing a good job, you know, we don't want to criticize them, but we want to say that, look, this people are commenting on it, which means that they're aware of this issue that you've brought up. But I think you just need to fix a little bit here and there. And
so
I think,
awareness has been both ways then.
Yeah.
Okay. Which then brings me to the most crucial question. I mean, October is budget month.
Yep.
Last year, we saw a cut in the budget for mental health. Not what you need at all. Is that going to make a difference? Do you expect a bigger budget?
I hope so. I don't control the purses or the bursary. I was informed that about 5% of the national budget is for health. And
slightly less than 5%
yeah, 4.6,
of GDP.
Yeah. And then after that, about 1% or 1.3% was contributed to mental health. I think more needs to be done, especially if the Ministry of Health is, you know, serious about their reforms in this area of mental health. I think they need to allocate a little bit more. And I think it needs to be an agenda equal to, for example, tobacco or HIV, which we've seen a lot of awareness on. And it needs to be more inclusive in terms of how we actually get this project off the ground. As we've discussed over the last hour now, there have been many stakeholders involved, and I think everybody needs to play their part and know where to play their part in this agenda for the nation.
And every one of us, Dr. Amir.
Yep, definitely.
Every one of us.
Every one of us.
If you want to start making a contribution, how do we do that?
Well, first of all, you could fund Befriend Us, KL. You know, they've come on board with us on this show as well before, and they said that they see about 80 cases a day, at least on phone calls, fully volunteer-based, fully self-supporting, so contribution there would be helpful. And of course, other NGOs also might need your help. Not only help in terms of resources, but also in terms of manpower. As I mentioned just now, rehabilitation requires people to volunteer, particularly if you're doing through non-governmental organizations. You know, you could also participate in terms of the many activities that the ministry and other agencies are doing in terms of mental health. And again, contribute for the national campaign, Let's Stop Minda Sehat. I think the least you could do is at least tell us what is good and what's not that great so that we can then further improve on those services for the betterment of Malaysia.
What's that hashtag again?
Let's Talk Minda Sehat.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us today. Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq, Amir Nordin, consultant psychiatrist from University Malaya Medical Center. In our psychiatry series, talking about Let's Talk Minda Sehat, also touched on the National Strategic Action Plan for Mental Health. Hopefully will be launched next year. On the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.